Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. As regular listeners to this program know, it's about interrelatedness, about tracking what I call the relational shift that's moving through all fields of endeavor and really all systems of knowledge as a result of the many recent discoveries in the past decade or so that the physical world, including humans, is far more dynamically interrelated than our modern schooling assumed. I gathered a lot of examples of these new discoveries in my book, Relational Reality, and since it went to press, this story, of course, has continued to break. So here's another example today of the area I call relational physiology. Now, last Sunday, an article in the Sunday Review section of the New York Times reported on research findings that being glued to an electronic device all day long reduces one's biological capacity to connect with other people. Yes. This article and study was headed by Barbara Fredrickson. She's a professor of psychology at University of North Carolina. And she's the author of the book Love 2.0: How Our Supreme Emotion Affects Everything We Feel, Think, Do, and Become. And the article is about this study that's about to be published in a forthcoming issue of Psychological Science. And again, Fredrickson is the lead researcher. This finding suggests that one measurable toll of paying way more attention to electronic devices than other humans during the course of a day suggests that our biological capacity to connect with other people may be compromised. There's increasing evidence that experiences leave imprints on our neural pathways. And this is a phenomenon they call neuroplasticity. So that means any habit, as they say here, molds the structure of your brain in ways that strengthen your proclivity for that habit. I would also say perceptions of the natural world. It's not only interactions with other people. They haven't gotten the eco half of this here. We want an eco-social analysis of all the dynamic relationships that we live in moment to moment. I mean, really, every cell in our body is in play. It's in play with this enormous web of dynamic relationships from people and the rest of nature. So it's nothing like that static, you know, you're born as 8 or 9 pounds of meat and you've got your set IQ and your set this and that. And that's the way the biomechanical model of the body has seen things, and that's the way the whole medical system evolved to match that model. But back to this recent piece of research that challenges that. It says that your habits of social connection leave their physical imprint on you. How much time do you typically spend with others? And when you do, how connected and attuned to them do you feel? Your answers to these simple questions may well reveal your biological capacity to connect. So this research team conducted a longitudinal field experiment on the effects of learning skills for cultivating warmer interpersonal connections in daily life. And what they did was have half of the participants in the study, and this half was chosen randomly out of the group, had them attend a 6-week workshop on what the psychologist here calls an ancient mind training practice known as metta, or loving kindness. And of course, what she doesn't say, she doesn't want to scare people away. This is something so foreign. This, of course, comes out of the Theravada tradition of Buddhism. And throughout the Southern Asian countries, the metta meditation is indeed to cultivate your capacity to not only perceive but generate loving kindness for all sentient beings. So in this scientific framework, they just call it, oh, why don't you come to a workshop and learn about loving kindness, this metta meditation, which they describe as teaching participants to develop more warmth and tenderness toward themselves and others. And the researchers discovered that the meditators not only felt more upbeat and socially connected, but they had also altered a key part of their cardiovascular system called the vagal tone, V-A-G-A-L. Scientists used to think that the vagal tone was largely stable, like your height in adulthood. In other words, it was another of their assumptions that, you know, you got your given, your physical reality. How could that be changed by something as amorphous as feelings and relationships? But they now see that this vagal tone, it's plastic, like the neural pathways in the brain. That is, it can be altered by habits of perception and cognition, or what they're calling your social habits. So it says your brain is connected to your heart by your vagus nerve. Well, I'm sure that's not the only way it's connected. That's kind of a mechanistic reduction of it. There are whole, I think, fields of energy, as many studies have shown, the heart energy influencing actions of the brain. But anyway, it is indeed one of the ways it's connected, let's say, is by this vagus nerve, V-A-G-U-S. And by and large, the higher your vagal tone, the better. It means your body is better able to regulate the internal systems that keep you healthy, like your cardiovascular, glucose, and immune responses. But one scientist also found that the vagal tone is central to things like facial expressivity and the ability to tune in to the frequency of the human voice. By increasing people's vagal tone, we increase their capacity for connection, friendship, and empathy. Well, I'd say it seems like they're connecting their ability to perceive and be attuned to this, which is certainly the first step, the baseline of what's needed to have an empathic exchange. So it says the more attuned to others you become, the healthier you become, and vice versa. This explains how a lack of positive social contact diminishes people. Your heart's capacity for friendship also obeys the biological laws of use it or lose it. So that takes Professor Fredrickson into this last section, this about this new field called social genomics. And this is coming off the research on the human genome, on how genes affect us. And this new field is the result of realizing that the ways genes are expressed at the cellular level is plastic. That is, it's changeable. It responds to habitual experiences and actions. And again, I would say it also responds all the time to various dynamic relationships from nature. You know, some people, their mood and all kinds of things throughout the body, they're affected by the barometer, the air pressure, how much sunlight they're getting. All kinds of things are affecting you throughout your body you're not even aware of. Work in social genomics, she says, reveals that our personal histories of social connection or loneliness, for instance, alter how our genes are expressed within the cells of our immune system. Yes, that's very true. Stress makes the protein, the epigenome around it, close over, cover over, and squeeze the gene so it can't be expressed. This is what they mean when they use that mechanistic metaphor. Oh, the gene is switched on or switched off. There's no mechanistic switch inside the gene. What they mean is it's covered over and sort of suppressed, or it's if you're not in a stressful station, that'll fall back so the gene can be expressed. So when you share a smile or laugh with someone face-to-face, Professor Fredrickson wants to emphasize, a discernible synchrony emerges between you as your gestures and biochemistries, even your respective neural firings, come to mirror each other. So they come into attunement with the other person's. And this, of course, is a very subtle exchange. It's micro moments like these, she says, in which a wave of good feeling rolls through two brains and bodies at once that build your capacity to empathize as well as to improve your health. So there we are, another example of relational physiology that really no physiologist would have guessed even 10 or so years ago. It just did not fit the model. And I think it adds another piece to the puzzle that I've talked about on this program before, of all those studies showing that empathy has gone way down in this culture. There's an organization that surveys young adults 18 to 34, I think. And especially after the year 2000, empathy is way, way down. Self-absorption, competitiveness, narcissism are way up. So, you know, one thinks about a lot of cultural factors that could be pushing that. But this study today that we're talking about, I think, adds another piece to the puzzle, that as people are spending more time on electronic devices, they're losing this capacity biologically to experience that kind of attunement when they're talking to another person. So why bother? And what does it matter what they're saying? Who cares if they have a problem? Empathy? What? You know. So I add this into the hopper today. And yeah, I think it's a hugely interesting giant mosaic that's starting to take shape. So let's move into our interview for today, which is with someone who, like these scientists, has discovered a lot about the power of realizing interrelatedness and cultivating interrelatedness. My guest today is Eleanor LeCain, who's an expert in social innovation and transformative programs. She brings to our discussion over 20 years of experience in finding and communicating breakthrough solutions in a variety of fields. She's put that knowledge into a book entitled Breakthrough Solutions, How to Improve Your Life and Change the World by Building on What Works. As executive director of Blueprint 2000, Eleanor LeCain was hired by the Massachusetts state government to create a strategic plan for the future of that state that addressed every area of public policy. She also served as the Massachusetts Assistant Secretary of State. Moreover, she's the founding president of Women of Vision and Action, an international network of spiritually aware women taking action for a better world. Eleanor LeCain earned a degree in economics from Yale and a degree in law and social policy from the University of California, Bolt Law School. She lives in Washington, D.C. with her husband and daughter, where she's the founder and president of The Breakthrough Way, which helps people and organizations find breakthrough solutions to improve lives and situations. Plus, I happen to know that she's also a very effective campaign strategist who worked in a key position in the successful campaign by U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren last fall. Eleanor LeCain, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Charlene. I'm delighted to be here with you today.
Well, I would like to hear about this whole concept of breakthrough solutions, what it is and how you arrived at it as something you wanted to focus on.
Great. I appreciate that. A breakthrough solution is really an approach that will give us dramatically better results than conventional methods for the same or less money than the methods that are most commonly used. And it's been my experience that we have these breakthrough solutions that could transform their entire field in every area of society.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it came about is I was working, as you mentioned, for the state government of Massachusetts. They hired me to do a strategic plan for the state government. And what I noticed when I was doing the planning was one town might have a solution that the town next door would not know about.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, this is ridiculous. Why aren't we talking to each other about what works?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, why don't we set up a system where people in one town that have a solution can communicate that to people in other towns so we could all be learning from the best of what works.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the idea came, and then I ended up looking for breakthrough solutions in different fields, and it's been, as you mentioned there, a 20-year odyssey, really a treasure hunt, looking for the best of what's working in America. And I just pulled together a profile of 9 breakthrough solutions in 9 different areas, like education, crime, parenting, and I put that in a book, The Breakthrough Solutions, How to Improve Your Life and Change the World by Building on What Works.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we get into some of those, we won't get through all 9, of course, but I would just like people to be able to keep in mind what your criteria were for selecting them. So you mentioned one, that it would cost less than solutions that attempt to address the same problems. What are the other ones?
That the criteria for a breakthrough solution also includes that you would demonstrate superior performance compared to the existing conventional approaches, so you get better results.
Right.
And that you have an extended track record of spectacular results over time.
Uh-huh.
And that approach can be repeated by someone else in another circumstance, that it's not dependent on one charismatic leader. And finally, that approach have the potential to transform the entire field. So we're not just talking about incrementally a better approach. We're talking about an approach that, if adapted and adopted more widely, could transform the entire field.
Okay, well, with that lens on, let's see what you found in this search. Maybe the first thing I'd like to hear about is parenting, particularly when a child has autism, because, you know, just last week the new figures came out from the Center for Disease Prevention, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and the autism rate now is 1 out of 50.
Oh,
American children. It's mostly boys, and some people are saying, well, this is partly because they're diagnosing better, and so the net is thrown a little wider. But the rate is going up so quickly, and of course, the medical community still does not understand the causes. There's a complex of about 12 candidates, which all have statistical research behind them as to what might be causing this, and it could be different synergistic combinations in different people. But I listed all those in Relational Reality. It's definitely a relational complex of causes, and I think because it's going up so quickly that the environmental factors really have to be looked at. Anyway, this is a shocking rate, and it's something a lot of parents in this country are dealing with. So I was very interested in this study you made of this.
Wonderful, yes. Well, you're exactly right. The rate of autism is rising dramatically. When I was doing the research for this book, just a few years ago, the rate was 1 in 110 children diagnosed, somewhere on the autism spectrum.
Yeah, which everyone is so shocked at back then.
Right, right. And that alone is extremely high, given what it was even a generation ago.
That's right.
So now it's 1 in 50. That's shocking. But I do agree. I think when you start thinking, well, what are the causes of it, we have to be looking at environmental factors. And I know there are people who are dealing successfully with the autistic challenges by the by watching the diet and what you eat and what kinds of what's being ingested by the child,
right,
and what's in the environment of the child, the toxins that are there that we may be unaware of in our carpets or clothing and other things.
Lawn treatments, yeah.
Right. So the truth is that no one really knows what the cause is for this dramatic rise.
Yeah.
And I think there may be multiple sources of what's bringing the dramatic rise. And I would say there is no way this is just because they're being diagnosed better. I think you know, if you know a child who's on the autism spectrum, you know this is serious challenges in the ability to communicate and in some cases not even having eye contact.
Oh, yeah. But
the thing that I found that was so wonderful and amazing is that whatever the cause, and it may be years before the scientists actually can track it down, whatever the cause is, that I found a program that is getting dramatic positive results with working with families who have children with autism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called the Sunrise Program at the Autism Treatment Center of America, based in Sheffield, Massachusetts. And the whole
Sunrise spelled S-O-N hyphen Rise, right?
Correct. Yeah, the S-O-N Rise program. And actually, there's a film made about the experience of this family that started the program. It was started by Mr. and Mrs. Kaufman to help their son Ron, who was diagnosed as profoundly autistic. And the doctors said, you know, the prognosis was grim, and they recommended that Ron be institutionalized and that there really was nothing much that anybody could do for him.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. and Mrs. Kaufman said, well, that's not good enough for our son. So they focused on how to help him, and they actually came up with and designed a program that helped their son Ron so that within 3 years he became a highly verbal, highly interactive, very bright young child.
Mm.
And Ron eventually went on not only to graduate from high school, but to graduate from Brown University, where he was on the debating team.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was a child that, you know, was the classic symptoms of, you know, sitting on the floor and not making eye contact and flapping his fingers in front of his eyes and kind of lost in his own world.
Mm-hmm.
To go from there to graduate of Brown College and on the debating team is just stunning.
Mm-hmm.
So the approach that they use, you know, people got word of it, so more and more families started going to the Kaufmans to say, what did you do? Because we need you to help with our son or our daughter, mostly sons, though. And they started helping people, and that's what led to this program at the Autism Treatment Center. And they've helped hundreds of families. Now, I don't believe there's any one approach that would help all children on the autism spectrum 100%. I think since there's probably multiple causes, there's probably multiple solutions.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do know is that this program, the Sunrise Program, dramatically helped Ron and is helping hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people across the United States and increasingly around the world to help the children be able to communicate much more fully and interact. And, you know, when you have a child who can't look you in the eye and is unable to even speak, to then be able to look in your eyes and say, I love you, Mom.
Yeah.
That's a very powerful program, and they've helped a lot of people make that progress and more.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of key principles or what did they arrive at through their own experiments? And I take it that they didn't have a medical background. They were just figuring this out as they went along, right, back in the early 70s?
Right, that's exactly right. And Mr. Kaufman was actually a marketing executive who was helping in advertising, and left a very high-paying job to help his son and then other families. And Mrs. Kaufman, I believe, was housewife and mother raising their other two daughters and then the son, Ron. So, no, they had no medical training, which I would say is probably an advantage.
Yeah, because they didn't believe it was impossible.
Exactly. They did not believe it was impossible. They believed it was possible, and they weren't trained into a certain way of thinking or way of dealing with it that has very limited positive results.
Right.
So they went for what they wanted, which is full communication and full ability to speak and interact in society. So, and that's what they got. And they were guided by some principles that they had learned kind of in philosophy about becoming happy. You know, how do you have happiness in life?
Hmm.
And the principles that they had learned in that program, they started applying to the children and families dealing with autism.
Oh, I see.
And actually, it's so perfect, Charlene, that you talked about relational physiology at the beginning of this program, because that is, I would say, fundamentally the most important thing that they do is they teach you, and I did this program with my daughter, the program based on these principles out there at Sheffield. My daughter was not autistic, but she had some very challenging special needs.
Uh-huh.
And I went out there to try and help her and us help her. So they were, I would say, it was a dramatic help to our family and helped keep our family together, because otherwise our daughter would have been institutionalized. So I speak from personal experience. This is an amazing program. And the key of it, I mean, you ask, you know, what's the core principle? It's to begin by surrounding yourself and the child and everybody in the family, surround with love, unconditional love, and know that everybody is doing the best they can given who they are and what they've experienced. So, you know, so often in these situations, you know, the parents might blame themselves on, you know, what do we do wrong? Do we have a genetic defect we passed on? Did we do some environmental or food thing that damaged
their
child?
And that makes them kind of glum,
It makes them glum. And then when you have a child, it's very hard socially, because instead of being proud about, and again, speaking from personal experience, I wanted to be proud about my daughter and how smart she was and what she was learning and what she was achieving. But if you have a kid with these special needs, then, you know, it's often not a lot to brag about, and you're often kind of apologizing or having a difficult time or dealing with problems because of social interactions, and it's very challenging. So surrounding yourself and the whole family with unconditional love is number one. And then number two is, instead of forcing the child to go into your life, that you go into their world. So if the child is there, like they did with their son Ron, if he's sitting on the floor flapping fingers in front of his eyes, you don't grab him by the shoulder and say, you know, come over here and learn your ABCs. What you do is you sit down with Ron in front of him and you flap your fingers in front of your eyes. And so then he, you know, that's what they did, literally. And then at some point, Ron actually looked at his mother in her eyes and kind of had a smile, and there was finally that point of connection. And then from there, they built on that. But it's go into their world. Don't force them into yours.
There's so much here, and I want to get into some of the other areas, but again, if you or anyone you know are parenting a child who is somewhere on the autistic spectrum of disorders, this program is called Sun-Rise Program. You could no doubt find it on the internet. And there's some others that I think, since these pioneering works have been done in the 70s, must have grown off of them. I just want to mention one more on the West Coast. This is one I mentioned in Relational Reality. It's a relational approach involving the parents. It's called the Developmental Individual Difference Relationship-Based Model, known as DIR Floor Time Therapy. So it sounds like it's the same thing. What the Kaufmans learned has been spread, you know, get down there and enter the world. So that's the DIR floor time therapy model. Okay, let's pause for a break here. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Eleanor LeCain, on All Together Now. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Eleanor LeCain, author of Breakthrough Solutions. Her website address is thebreakthroughway.com. thebreakthroughway.com. So just written as one word, thebreakthroughway.com. And Eleanor, is it only through the website that people can buy the book Breakthrough Solutions, or are there other channels?
Yes, right now Breakthrough Solutions is available only on the BreakthroughWay.com website.
Okay.
I will be releasing it officially later this year, and it will be available through Amazon and so forth later on, but right now just the website.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, I'd like to hear about one or two more examples of these areas you looked at and these solutions that you found that are successful, low-cost, and replicable. since we're not going to get through all nine areas, could you tell the listeners now what those nine areas are that you have these examples in?
Sure. Yeah, the first area where there's a breakthrough solution is the parenting that we discussed, and I think that's so foundational. That's why I put it as the first chapter.
Mm.
And then the second is crime, education, peace and conflict transformation, marriage and relationships, creating green jobs, increasing prosperity, and philanthropy.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And then there's a chapter on how to bring the solutions around more widely. So it's just looking at when you have a breakthrough, how do you get it to be better known? So there's a whole chapter on that.
Well, that I'm very interested in. So I'm going to jump to that right now so we don't run out of time, because I myself have often noticed solutions that were low cost, extremely successful, and replicable that didn't get beyond their immediate area. And I wonder what your insights are as to why that is so often the case. Is it because our country's so big or something? I mean, it seems like in a lot of European countries, they have better mechanisms for sharing solutions that are working, new solutions that come up from various sources. So why do you think we have that problem here?
I would say there's four major reasons why breakthrough solutions are not being built upon more widely. The first is that the models are not well known by the general public or even by decision makers in their fields. So people who deal with children with autism, for example, may not know about the Sunrise program.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, there are, it's just basic inertia. People are used to doing things in a certain way. So they kind of have their track that they're known and familiar, and something that's new is this kind of a resistance to, and it's hard to get people to change how they do things. And third, and very importantly, that the people who benefit from the current situation often actively resist change.
Yeah.
Because their jobs or their profits depend on keeping the same approach going now. So, for example, we have a model for criminal rehabilitation in Delancey Street, has very successful rates of rehabilitating.
Yeah.
In San Francisco, rehabilitating drug addicts and criminals.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a whole prison industrial complex where there's $68 billion a year being spent to incarcerate people. And there's some people...
And reincarcerate,
And reincarcerate, and they come out of prison. It's a problem not solved because they commit another crime and go back to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And why wouldn't they? They're just coming out into the same environment they were in when they
mm-hmm.
committed the crime in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really solving the problem, but it is making some people a lot of money. $68 billion is people whose jobs and profits depend on the prison industrial complex.
Hmm.
So those are kind of the three major reasons. And I would say the fourth one, and this is kind of a doorway into a solution, the fourth reason we don't build on breakthrough solutions is because there's no systematic way to identify and build on breakthrough solutions. There is, it's no one's job to say what's the best school for educating inner-city kids.
Hmm.
There's no one whose job it is to say, well, what's the best way of helping someone who's committed a crime get back on the straight and narrow and becoming productive members of our communities? There is no systematic way to identify and build on these breakthrough solutions. And that's why I set up the Breakthrough Way to communicate these solutions so they more widely known and have people have the chance to see them, to communicate those solutions to the general public and to decision makers in each of the fields where we have the solutions, and build up a public demand so people say, we can do this. We don't want to be wasting our tax money and our time on methods that are, you know, maybe so-so or maybe ineffective or maybe slightly effective. Mm-hmm. We want to do this approach, which is more effective for less money. And mm-hmm. when people know it exists, they can demand it. It's like Eleanor Roosevelt once said, if it exists, it's possible. Mm-hmm. And I'm convinced after the 20 years of research that we have solved virtually every problem in the society already, that someone somewhere has the wow. solution, whether it's in helping kids with autism, helping criminals get back on the straight and narrow and becoming productive members of society, mm-hmm. Helping eliminate poverty, improving relationships and decreasing the divorce rate and increasing the length of marriage and the joy of relationships in marriage. All of these things we now know how to do, and that's my mission, is to identify these breakthrough solutions, communicate them widely, and mobilize people to use these solutions in their lives, in their communities, and encourage their government officials to be building on the breakthrough solutions as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to tell you that listening to you, I have had a vision here.
Oh, wonderful.
I think it would be great if you, who have indeed, you know, pioneered this by finding these 9 in-depth models, get a nice big grant for Breakaway Solutions to do a big database divided into the different fields of things that meet the criteria, low cost, replicable, high, long-standing success rate, and, you know, a place where people could look, because now things are available online. You know, it's a giant reference library. It's terrific for research. And so that's a way horizontal communication could work. So, you know, I see you with this whole big room of all your minions at their laptops, oh dear, damaging their biological capacity. They better get off those laptops for a nice 2-hour lunch break. But anyway, have you ever thought of making a database of breakthrough solutions?
Yes, that is totally my dream. I live for that day when we can have that database online available to the people across the country and around the world. Here is the best of what's working in America. Here's the best of what's working in China and in Russia, and that we have people all over the world identifying what's working in their communities and then sharing that globally. So I would like to at least start with the United States. Because
yeah, that goes beyond. I was just thinking of doing it for the United States. Okay.
Yeah, just do it. Let's start here in the United States. We're the ones who invented the Internet. Let's make good use of it. And we're also big inventors in communications, which it's been sad for me to see how our communications has so much focused on what's breaking down, not on what's breaking through. Oh. And they're focusing so much on the problems and the fires and the corruption instead of on the solutions and the magic and the people helping people. So I would love to contribute to that communications with an online destination spot, kind of a one-stop shop for the best of what's working in America.
Yeah.
I actually wrote up a proposal for Obama when he was running for office in 2008 that he set up the Office of Breakthrough Solutions in the White House. And I've had some, you know, communications with my friend Barbara Marks Hubbard, had a similar dream for decades on the Peace Room. So I won't go into the detail, but I did talk to very high level people in the Obama administration. I was invited to meet with the transition team when he was coming in, and they actually did set up kind of an Office of Social Innovation, they did not take the approach of looking at the breakthrough solutions, and they have helped. It's a completely different thing. They're basically giving some grants to some groups that are doing good work. which is fine, but they're missing the strategic element here is to focus on the breakthrough solutions, not
right.
just good approaches that are incrementally better, but the breakthrough solutions that transform the whole field. If we could set that up, at I was hoping we'd do that through the federal government, set it up and then communicate it to mayors and governors and citizens all across the country, I see it strategically as the fastest way we can help the most number of people dramatically improve our quality of life for billions of dollars less than we currently spend.
Hmm.
So that's my dream. I really want to do it. When Obama didn't do it or kind of did it a step in that direction but missing the strategic framework for it, I thought, well, you know, let's just do it myself. I do it myself. So
yeah,
that would be great if I could raise the money and find the people to help me put that wonderful kind of
gateway to breakthrough. Well, you could try a Kickstart campaign, but I think mm-hmm. if everyone listening, if they're connected to any kind of philanthropist or philanthropic foundation, should give them a call and tell them about this, have them listen to the tape, and leave a message on the breakthroughway.com website that we are just itching to give you a big grant because this is so important. And here's a chance for the philanthropic community to make up for the fact that they really have not funded alternative communication over the past 40 years the way the right has. And they would give startup money, but then if you couldn't pay for it all in 3 years, it had to fold. You know, the only progressive journals that have lasted decades have a family, a philanthropic family behind it, or ongoing grants. And instead, the whole eco-social network usually just would say sink or swim after a little startup grant. So here's a chance to make up for all that and really do something that could shift out of crises into solutions. Well, we have a little bit of time for shorthand answers from you on a couple more areas that I think are on a lot of people's minds. And one is the problem with public education, especially with our urban schools, which are turning out children so ill-prepared to cope with life and thrive. So you have a very interesting study there of Deborah Meyer, this educator in New York, and these two schools that she started. Can you just describe them quickly? And then I think her core principles, there's a couple of really interesting things in the core principles she arrived at.
Yes, exactly. This is an approach to education promoted by Deborah Meyer, who started a grade school in Harlem, New York, and then had such great results with it. It called the Central Park East.
Yeah, and, Central Park East Secondary School.
Well, yeah, from the grade school, people said, we don't want to go from this wonderful educational experience into the traditional New York schools and kind of just crash and burn with that same old, same old. So she actually set up a high school so the people from the grade school would have a place to continue with that same philosophy and practice. She started the Central Park East secondary school, the high school there, and just had spectacular results. And there was actually a fellow who studied that whole program thinking, oh, well, Deborah Meyer was cherry-picking, and she started with bright students who would be successful anyway.
Oh.
And actually his book, you know, describes the whole thing and says, no, that's completely wrong. In fact, the average student at the Central Park East was actually much more challenged coming from home conditions of poverty and violence and a lot of dysfunction, and they themselves having a lot of special needs. And yet even with all of those challenges, she created a school where people, the teachers and the students, were excited about learning. And 90% of the kids who graduated went to college, and 95% of them graduated. So
it's remarkable.
This in the middle of Harlem. So I actually was hoping to, I thought, gosh, maybe I'll move to Harlem because, you know, we had adopted our special needs girl. I thought maybe we'll go to Harlem to see if we can get her into Central Park East. But then Deborah Meyer moved to Boston, where I used to live, and she set up a school in Roxbury based on the same philosophy and practice called the Mission Hill School, which is still going. And my daughter did go in there, and it totally changed her life. She went from, like, third grade and unable to read to and problematic, hated school. In fact, she sat down on the sidewalk one day when I was bringing her to her old school. She sat down on the sidewalk and said, I'm not going in.
But
once she got into Deborah's school at the Mission Hill, my daughter said, you know, I love this place. When it was time for summer vacation, she was sad because she didn't want school to end.
it was a real community for them. Well, I saw in your book that she has arrived at the fact that schools, and I've read this elsewhere, have a better success rate if they're not huge impersonal structures, which is off-putting to the kids. It makes them feel anonymous and invisible.
Right.
So small schools, preferably no more than 250 students, small classes, personalized instruction. And then this is interesting, active learning with student as worker / student as citizen and teacher as coach. Can you say something about that? We just have a little bit of time here.
Yeah, basically, instead of the teacher being at the front of the room lecturing the students to pump information into their brains, it's more the teacher is a coach and saying, well, what are you interested in? Like Veronica was interested in nature and animals, so they found books on nature and animals and really coaching her, and she learned to read and write, not by focusing, I have to read and write, but by saying, I love animals, I want to learn about animals, so I need to read this book to learn about animals, that kind of thing. It's a fantastic approach. It's based on following the students' interests, and learning happens almost secondarily as they're pursuing what they're curious about.
Wow. I think the only thing that would some people say not be cheaper than the way things are done now are the small class size, because with all the budget cuts, I know out here in California, there was such a victory, 15, 20 years ago to get elementary school class sizes down to 28, especially the lower grades. And now with the budget cuts, it's up to 34, 35. Just to throw that in the pot. But there are all kinds of other areas here. Conflict solutions, very interesting. These are all in the book, Breakthrough Solutions. So that's all the time we have for talking with Eleanor about this book. But I have an announcement now about the program altogether now. Very exciting news for regular listeners to this program, and that is, for reasons that will be obvious to you now, having listened to her this hour, I have invited Eleanor Lacaine to join this program altogether now as my co-host. And she's going to host the show every other Thursday starting next week, and I'll host on the Thursdays in between. So, yes, next week, April 4th, will be her first program. And I think I realized more in this hour even than I had how closely related our books are. Breakthrough Solutions and Relational Realities cover a lot of the same areas. They're looking for those, you know, relational solutions to these long-standing, seemingly intractable problems. So this just feels like a great fit to me. And Eleanor, welcome very much to the program.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be doing this program with you, Charlene. Thank you for the opportunity to spread the word about the Breakthrough Solutions.
Yeah, well, we'll have a good time. And I look forward to listening to your hosting next week. So we're going to move over into the Arts Corner now and see what we have there. We have a song, by the way, in honor of Eleanor's coming on and these changes shaking up our schedule a little bit. But we'll start first with a poem. And this week we have one by Kay Ryan. She was the Poet Laureate of the United States from 2008 through 2010. And she taught for many years in a community college in Northern California. This poem is from her collection entitled The Niagara River, which won the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize. And the poem itself is entitled Almost Without Surface. So it's another one about interrelatedness between us and the larger context, almost without surface. Sometimes before going to sleep, a person senses the give behind the last given, almost physically, like the strain of plush against a skin. The person imagines a fig or peach, perhaps a woman or a deep constellation, some fathomless fruit. But we are each that while we live, however much we resist, almost without surface, barely contained, but crazy as clouds compounding each other, refusing to rain. And our song today, as I say, in honor of our new co-host, Eleanor LeCain's arrival next week, is the Dave Brubeck Quartet, with one of their recordings from the sessions they did with the vocalist Jimmy Rushing in 1960. And this song is There'll Be Some Changes Made. And you will, of course, hear Paul Desmond on the alto sax.
There's a change in the weather, change in the sea. From now on there'll be a change in me. Walk will be different, my talk and my name. Nothing about me's gonna be the same. Change my long gone for a little short man. Change my number where I'm stopping at. Nobody wants you when you're old and gray. There'll be some changes made today. There'll be some changes made. Change in me. What will be different, my talk and my name. Nothing about me's gonna be the same. Change my long gone for a little short fast. Change my number where I'm stopping at. Nobody wants you when you're old and gray. There'll be some changes made today.
That was the Dave Brubeck Quartet and Jimmy Rushing with There'll Be Some Changes Made. Dave Brubeck on piano, Joe Morello, of course, on drums, Paul Desmond on alto sax. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest, Ron Kaufman. Now, he is the young man who was the very young child with autism and no longer has autism. Ron Kaufman on the subject of overcoming autism and other seemingly insurmountable life challenges. I'll be back 2 weeks from today with my guest, Marcia Beauchamp, who directs projects in interfaith dialogue for the Tony Blair Faith Foundation. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.